From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, a new study shows Marin County has disproportionately higher numbers of melanoma skin cancer from the rest of the Bay Area. The report from the Cancer Prevention Institute of California noted that melanoma incidence was 60% higher in Marin. That's compared to the state as a whole. And experts will join us to explain those findings and offer skin safety and screening tips for the summer. That's next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Skin cancer is what we're going to focus on this hour. It's the most common of all cancers, and melanoma is the deadliest of all skin cancers. In 2014, there were over 76,000 cases. Small changes in size make it much more dangerous, and cases are growing worldwide. According to a recent study released just last week by the Cancer Prevention Institute, the highest number of cases in the Bay Area are in Marin County, 60% higher than the state's total. Breast cancer rate statistics are also still 10% higher in Marin County than in California as a whole, and 20% higher than the national average. And in this opening forum hour, we want to focus on these latest statistics about skin cancer and also how to best care for your skin as the summer moves on and prevent melanomas. And with us in studio is Tina Clark. She's a research scientist with the Cancer Prevention Institute of California. She's also lead co-author on the recent report about melanoma incidence in Marin County. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Also good to have Susan Sweater with us by phone this morning. She's professor of dermatology at Stanford University and director of the Stanford Melanoma Program there. Susan Sweater, good to have you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. We'll also say good morning to Sonia Lunder. She's a senior analyst with the Environmental Working Group there, a nonprofit public health and environmental research group that puts out a yearly report evaluating sunscreen. Sonia Lunder, welcome to Forum.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And let's begin with Tina Clark here in studio. Well, 43%, let's just talk about Marin for a moment, than the rest of the Bay Area. But it's a fairly white, affluent population, and one could almost transpose that anywhere, I suppose, and with educated people and fairly affluent or semi-affluent, find similar statistics, couldn't we?
Absolutely. We know Marin County is a very special county in California. It is the most affluent. It's about 75% white. It's just really different than other counties in California, and I think that's why we see very different cancer statistics there.
But the reporting and the earlier diagnosis must play into this, too. I mean, there's improved screening, and the demographics of Marin make it also a likely candidate to see these kinds of numbers.
Absolutely. Everything we see here is consistent with what we know about melanoma occurrence. It follows a socioeconomic gradient. It's certainly more likely to strike folks who have a pale complexion, the blonde hair, red hair, blue eyes, green eyes, pale skin, Northern European background. Those
lacking in melanin,
yes,
basically.
Absolutely.
You know, I happened to go to the ball game yesterday, and I went with a dermatologist who I think is from Marin, Louis Tannenbaum, and he said almost every mole is checked in Marin. People are on the watch out early. They're much more aware of those things. And there's excellent treatment in addition, so the survival rate for melanoma is pretty high there, too.
We've reported that higher proportions of melanomas in Marin County are indeed caught when they're smaller and thinner and more curable, which is good news, but we still thought it was important to get these statistics out there and tell people that the overall burden of this cancer in this population is very, very high, and they need to know and they need to start taking action for themselves and their children and teenagers to reduce UV exposure and reduce their risk.
Needs to be more targeted, in other words. I mean, regionally. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think we need more educational information out there for folks to understand what a lifetime of sun exposure can do to your skin and can do to your melanoma risk.
Well, we always can use education on safe sun exposure, and I presume we'll take that up in the course of this hour. But also, do we need better screening for at-risk people generally? And if so, what does that mean?
Dr. Sweater could talk more about this. Melanoma screening is quite controversial because, frankly, we just don't have the clinical trial data to tell us what kind of screening regimen is effective at reducing mortality. And overall, melanoma deaths are actually quite rare when tumors are caught early. So we just don't have the statistics to tell us the right thing to do. But perhaps the dermatologist could tell us a little bit more about what they think you know, the most recent data should tell us what to do.
Well, Susan Sweater, what does the recent data tell us?
Well, the best data we have right now, Michael, comes from Germany, where a statewide screening program in a northern state called Schleswig-Holstein was conducted between 2003 2004. And this was a screening of over 360,000 individuals over the age of 20, both men and women, by both primary care doctors and dermatologists, with a concerted effort to engage and teach primary care doctors how to perform a skin exam and then triage those patients effectively to skin specialists if they had concern lesions. And what they found is 5 years after the screening, the mortality rates, the death rates from melanoma had dropped by nearly 50% in both men and women compared to surrounding states and countries without the screening. And so this was a suggestion, not a controlled trial, as Tina Clark said, but a very strong suggesting that screening could make a difference in terms of reducing melanoma mortality. And in fact, the state now the country of Germany since 2008 is conducting a nationwide screening of the population with over 30 to 40 million people screened to date. And so we'll have very good data in the next few years from Germany as to whether this statewide initiative had a great impact on the national level, and then how we can extrapolate those data in the United States, which is, of course, a very different country, much larger, much more heterogeneous in terms of the racial ethnic mix, but still much data to be gleaned from that. Just to comment further, I think we know now, particularly as dermatologists and folks specializing in melanoma, that if we target those at highest risk, those that Tina was mentioning with fair skin, family history of skin cancer, lots of moles, lots of sun damage, other skin cancers, we really can make a difference in detecting melanoma early and saving lives.
There's also, it's not only fair skin, or those with a lot of moles, family history, but other types of skin cancer, right?
Exactly. That having just the other types of skin cancer, basal cell and squamous cells, which are the most common human cancers worldwide, actually increases the risk of melanoma by at least threefold. And again, that tends to go along with an individual's genetic and background and their skin phenotype, where we're seeing fair skin individuals more susceptible to all types of skin cancer.
Well, if we look to Germany for screening, I suppose, can we look to Australia for sun protection? I mean, they have an aggressive program for school kids.
Absolutely. Australia has really set the bar and set it high for other countries to follow suit. And the U.S., I think, is doing a great job. There's room to move. The most compelling data we have now from Australia are actually regarding sunscreen itself, which until recently, much like screening, have never been shown in a controlled trial setting to prevent melanoma. And there was a study conducted in Australia in the early 1990s, so 1992 to 1996, in adults over 25 using just an SPF 16 sunscreen. The sunscreens weren't as good as they are now. They weren't as broad spectrum in terms of reaching far UVA light. And individuals were asked to put the sunscreen on the face, ears, and arms every day versus on a discretionary or optional use. 10 years later, after this four-year intervention, there was a 50% reduction in melanoma rates. And so this is a randomized, prospective, controlled trial, which is now showing that sunscreen makes a difference, although we don't, in the U.S. and other countries, don't rely on sunscreen alone. We really want to actually advocate for sun protective practices, which include clothing, hat, eyewear, avoidance of sun in the midday, and so on.
And long sleeves.
Exactly. Yeah. Long sleeves, if you can find the comfortable clothing, which I'm pleased to say is being increasingly sold in commercial venues and stores where it's a little bit more affordable. It used to be, I think, quite expensive.
And Susan Sweater, again, is professor of dermatology at Stanford University Medical Center and directs the Stanford Melanoma Program there. Sonia Lunder is senior analyst with the Environmental Working Group. That's a nonprofit public health and environmental research group that puts out a yearly report evaluating sunscreen. So we talked about Germany, we talked about Australia. If you look at Europe, they're doing a lot better with sunscreens, aren't they, Sonia Lunder?
Yeah, this is the one critical piece of the equation, in our opinion. We're a public health advocacy organization, and one thing we think about in addition to people changing their behavior is a market that provides the safest and most effective products to them. We see that in America we have a pretty lackluster history in setting strong rules for sunscreen products. We have a lot of mismarketing with SPF values as high as 110 on store shelves, where everywhere else in the world SPF values are capped at 30 or 50. Because we find that some ways that we market sunscreen really lead to an overblown understanding of what they may do for you. People put on sunscreen once and they never put it on again for the rest of the day. They use products like SPF 100 and may never get burned, but they're not using that product properly. And as a result, we think that that sunscreen labels need to be better, products need to be better, and that's a critical piece to actually offering better protection and combating diseases like melanoma.
Well, in fact, as far as what you read on sunscreen, the whole idea that above 50 provides you better protection is somewhat misleading, I think. Although, as I said, I was chatting with this dermatologist yesterday at the ballpark, and he was saying, well, you get more time with 50, so it is better protection. I mean, let's see if we can sort some of this out with you, because they also, a lot of these sunscreens claim to be waterproof, and that may be misleading as well.
Yeah, FDA has been taking its sweet time to set strong rules on sunscreen protection. It has indicated that it thinks SPF values above 50 are actually misleading to consumers, leads people to apply them less and to reapply them less frequently. And that's a reason that SPF values are capped in Europe and also in Australia. We also find that there are new and better sunscreen ingredients that are used elsewhere.
And then zinc and titanium?
Those are reasonably good, and they offer, you know, photostable protection, meaning they won't be broken down by sunlight as much as some of the other ingredients on the market. But there's some new and kind of promising ingredients used in Europe, and applications to approve those for use in the U.S. have been sitting at the FDA for up to 8 years without any kind of action. And actually, today, the House of Representatives is voting on a bill that would set clear timelines for FDA to actually review and approve or deny these sunscreen ingredients that may, really improve our ability to make good, lasting sunscreens in the U.S. The other thing in Europe is they have a pass-fail test for sunscreens, and if you don't offer strong protection from UVA rays, which are one of the types of UV
Sonia, I'm sorry, could
radiation.
You distinguish for us UVA and UVB?
Okay, the first point is, in Europe, there's a pass-fail test for sunscreen, and you can't sell a sunscreen that doesn't offer strong and broad-spectrum protection. In the U.S., it's perfectly legal to sell a really inferior sunscreen product, and actually lots of sunscreens on the market claim to help prevent skin cancer but don't offer strong enough protection to be sold in Europe. One of the critical problems with sunscreen is they were developed to stop sunburn, and they're fairly good at that, but they don't often protect from the other types of UV rays that are striking the earth. And one type of ray that we're worried about for skin damage and also skin aging and even melanoma risk are the UVA rays. And they're lower energy. They penetrate deeper into the skin. They can cause immune system suppression and some precancerous skin damage and skin aging. And sunscreens don't always do a good job at blocking those types of rays. And you can't necessarily tell from reading the label alone if you're getting a sunscreen that's strong or good in the UVA range. And you don't get that worrisome sign like a sunburn that tells you that you've done something wrong and that you need to correct your behavior in the future. So that's one of the big deficiencies that we'd like to see fixed or improved in U.S. sunscreens.
Well, it's the Sunscreen Innovation Act, and that would essentially strengthen the FDA in terms of regulation, safety, effectiveness, and labeling. That's in the works, as I understand it. What's the status of that bill, you know?
So there's a House vote today that will actually address just the issue of approving or reviewing new sunscreen ingredients, and that would be scheduled for a vote in the Senate later this year. But this could be a clear move by Congress to actually push FDA to speed up its analysis and to potentially approve these new and slightly better UVA protectors that are commonly used in Europe and elsewhere.
Well, I know that you, the listeners, have a lot of questions, and so I want to open the phone lines now and give you an opportunity to talk with our panelists. Great deal of concern about disproportionate rates of melanoma found in Marin County, a new study that we've been using as sort of a catalyst to discuss just how you can be safer in the sunshine, and there's a lot of it. A lot of sunshine, not enough water. But let me give you a phone number and invite you to join us. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. So feel free to join the program with any questions or comments you might have. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. There are a number of other ways to join the program. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can go right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Or go to our Facebook page. And let's talk about waterproofing for a moment with you, Sonia Lunder, if we can. I mean, again, as far as consumers are concerned, what should you look for on a label that will tell you sunscreen is good? I mean, in terms of protecting and waterproofing and all the rest of it.
Yeah, well, until recently, it was legal to sell a sunscreen that claimed to be waterproof or offer all-day protection, and these claims are just not true. No product on the market can completely protect your skin. New rules do require testing and data to say that you're water resistant, and that's either for 40 or 80 minutes. But no matter what, people need to be putting on quite a thick layer of sunscreen. I have taken to applying one layer on my face, waiting a little bit, and then putting it on again just within a couple of minutes, really, to get enough. And also reapplying often. I mean, I think one of these big problems with SPF values up to 100 is that no one would ever think to put it on every 90 minutes. But when you're in the intense sun, it's breaking down by sunlight. It's rubbing off your body, and it's washing off your body. That's why, we think the prevention message really needs to shift to preventing sunburn. And the best strategy for doing that, as was mentioned earlier, is using protective clothing, wearing a hat, avoiding those intense periods of the day where the sun is just beating down on you between 10 and 4, we're thinking about in the summertime, and really thinking about sunscreen as one tool, but only one tool in preventing sunburn.
And we should mention that the concerns we have about melanoma are more true for an aging population throughout the Bay Area. There's an increase in races and ages all over, but I think, Susan, sort of it's safe to say that older men and women should get screened at least annually?
Absolutely. Again, we don't have formal guidelines that the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has issued, but there's ample data to suggest, including in this Marin County report by CPIC, that men in particular over the age of 65 had the highest rates of melanoma, and we see that worldwide. We also see it in older women, although not to the same extent. So ensuring that we practice not only primary prevention, which is the sun protection practices, but the secondary prevention piece, which is early detection, is critical, and focusing on older age individuals with fair skin and or other risk factors for melanoma and skin cancer is really crucial in this effort.
It's strange, though, Tina Clark, that those who work outdoors seem less, I mean, that's almost counterintuitive, less vulnerable.
Right. We really see for melanoma risk, it's interesting that it's this intermittent, intense sun exposure. So it's maybe keeping your skin covered all winter and then flying to Hawaii and blasting it with sun, that it's those intermittent intense exposures that seem to be most associated with risk. And furthermore, it's when you get those kind of exposures consistently throughout your lifetime, in your childhood, in your adolescence, when we look back at the data that people report after having been diagnosed with melanoma, that it seems to be those kind of unexpected sun exposures that your skin might be battling that ultimately increase your risk as an older person.
Well, I was also reading that the left-sided skin cancers can come about from UV while driving a car.
Absolutely. There's some really interesting photos out there on Twitter and Facebook showing the difference in skin damage and sun damage and UV damage on, truck drivers and the left side and the right side. It's worth looking up.
Should we say something, too, about workplace exposure and tanning booths? I mean, I know if you're exposed to coal tar or pitch or
things
like that.
Absolutely, right. We just, the World Health Organization just last year pronounced tanning beds a class one carcinogen, which means that the scientific evidence is absolutely clear that they cause skin cancer. California was the first state in 2011 to ban minors from being able to access tanning beds, and many states and other municipalities have followed. So tanning salons are certainly completely off the table when it comes to talking about skin cancer prevention.
Sonia Lunder, can you give us an idea what maybe the best products are out there?
My organization, Environmental Working Group, does an annual survey of sunscreens on the market. We see good and bad products, across all different brands. But really, the key things we urge people to look for are SPF values between maybe 15 and 50, depending on, what you're going to use them for, what type of sunlight and sun intensity you're seeking, and your body's ability to tan or your frequency of burning. We recommend people look for zinc oxide and titanium dioxide because those ingredients are not broken down as much in the sunlight, and they offer reasonably good UVA protection. And to avoid sprays, there's concern by FDA and definitely something we've been concerned about for all our years of sunscreen advocacy, are sprays not giving a thick enough coating on the skin, also the potential for inhalation. We've all been downwind from someone spraying their kids off with sunscreen and had it in our breathing zone as well. And we also have a sun safety campaign that is really trying to elevate this issue and discussion of skin cancer prevention, really drill down these points of sun protection and not relying completely on sunscreen, but taking time to pick a good sunscreen and to avoid sunburn as the key strategies to really prevent melanoma.
All right, let me go to our callers, and we begin with a caller from Texas. Melissa, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. My hands tell the story of being growing up in Texas and before sunscreen, the sun damage on my hands and my arms from being in a car. And I now put sunscreen on my hands and forearms every day, just hope there won't be any more sun damage. But my question is, the European products, are there any, can we buy them online? Can they be ordered, some of the better European products? And if so, can you tell me what they are or tell me where I could find them?
Sonia Lunder.
Yes, we have this question often, and it's actually illegal to sell sunscreen products in the United States that don't comply with the U.S. labeling rules and have the U.S. warnings on them. So it's not something that consumers can do. We know people are really passionate about finding good products and feel really frustrated when they learned that they may not have access to the good ingredients or that they may be sold products with misleading claims or ingredients that may be hazardous. And this is something that we need to fix across the country, and the way to fix it is for FDA to pass better rules and to put more restrictions on the use of some of the concerning ingredients.
Let me thank Melissa for the call. I want to get another caller on, and that's you. Waits, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Michael. Excellent program on a timely topic. My question for your experts is this, could they give us a more definitive definition of early detection of melanoma? Is it a few weeks, a few months, a year, or what?
Yeah, Susan Sweater.
It's a great question. There are certain subtypes of melanoma that grow more quickly. They can look like a bug bite. They don't have to be brown in color, which is the majority of the melanomas we see. So if you notice something on your skin that is changing differently than the rest, whether it looks like a non-healing acne pimple or sore, if it's red or brown, important to get that looked at early. Other melanoma types, particularly those we see located on the head and neck in older age individuals in their seventh decade of life and beyond, tend to have a much more slow-growing nature. They tend to evolve over many years. They can be a brown spot that slowly enlarges in diameter, and then if any nodule develops in it, we know it's already becoming a deeper melanoma. So the bottom line is to think about skin lesions like the ugly duckling phenomenon. It's often easier to remember than the traditional ABCDE criteria for melanoma warning signs. And the point is to look at something that is different than the rest. It doesn't match your other skin lesions. And so if that is the case, then you want to notify your healthcare provider and have him or her either refer you to a dermatologist or reassure you that that's a harmless finding or perform a biopsy. So there are different subtypes that can be detected in different time frames is my point.
We're coming up on a break. We'll continue taking your calls when we return. Remind you that we're talking about disproportionate rates of melanoma that have been found in Marin and concerns about melanoma and ways to essentially stop skin cancer and prevent it. And if you'd like to join us, you can do so by emailing us forum@kqed.org or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment. Tina Clark with us in studio, research scientist with the Cancer Prevention Institute of California. Susan Sweater with us online, professor of dermatology at Stanford University Medical Center. And Sonia Lunder also with us online, senior analyst with the Environmental Working Group. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. There's a new study that shows that Marin County has disproportionately higher numbers of melanoma skin cancer than the rest of the Bay Area. We're using that essentially to talk about melanoma and to talk about sunscreen and prevention of melanoma. Even though there's a listener here who sees us working in some rich ghetto conspiracy, this is a listener who writes, rich white people are more likely to see the right doctor and be diagnosed, put on sunscreen and wear a hat, case closed, waste of Forum time. But since Krasny lives in Marin County, this is not the first time his hood and his friends who live there have gotten undue airtime without full disclosure. Well, there's full disclosure. It always amazes me what comes through here. But let me go to you on this, Tina Clark. We're trying to prevent skin cancer here. We're trying to prevent melanomas. Marin was just a catalyst to talk about this. It's not so easy. You see the right doctor and you put on a sunscreen and wear a hat.
It's not so easy. I think we've got many decades of ingrained behaviors. Tanning became fashionable in the late 1920s when Coco Chanel showed up from, you know, being on the south of France. And that really was when people's behaviors in many westernized countries shifted quite dramatically from sun avoidance to seeking the sun and enjoying sun vacations. So we've got many years of kind of cultural norms to change. I was just mentioning during the break that those of us with older kids and teenagers, getting them to really change what kind of clothes they wear out in the sun and think about long sleeve swim shirts and, you know, what kind of clothing is available and is cool to them is also a big challenge. So I think we've got our work cut out for us in terms of changing a lot of very longstanding cultural traditions and preferences about tanned skin and what kind of clothes we wear out in the sun, et cetera.
Well, let me go to a few more less rude web postings and emails here. This is from Ben, who writes, I've been a huge fan of the new breed of spray-on sunscreens. They are much easier to apply and without all the mess. Are they as effective as their goopy rub-in counterparts? Sonia Lunder?
I'm not sure exactly what the listener refers to for the new generation, but we are very concerned about the aerosolized products, those that come out in a big cloud. And FDA itself is soliciting data and input to try to ask manufacturers to prove that these are actually safe and effective products. I think the risk is too great to be missing patches of your skin. It's not ever appropriate to spray aerosol sunscreen on your face. So no matter what, you're going to be putting it on your hands, and that inconvenient step of rubbing it on your face is not to be avoided. You should actually be rubbing in any sunscreen you spray anywhere on your body. But when it comes back to our recommendations, we think the lotion forms of sunscreen are definitely safest.
Can I go to a tweet with you also, Sonia Lunder? A listener wants to know, what happens when sunscreens pass their expiration date?
You know, it's not exactly clear what happens. It probably depends on the formulation you're talking about and how far past the date. If you notice any change, I think, in the smell or the texture, it's probably good to get rid of it. And actually, if you're using sunscreen appropriately and you have a somewhat active lifestyle, you're going to be using up those lotions before they expire. So it may be a sign that you need to be buying and applying sunscreen more frequently.
And here's a listener who writes, your guest mentioned sun protective clothing and how the prices have come down. They are still quite expensive. There's a product made by RIT called SunGuard that is added to a load of wash. Anybody know how well this works? It's a very inexpensive solution, the listener writes, if it's any good.
You know,
I was going to say, I don't think the product's taken off. It's been on the market for about 10 years. And it's many of the clothes we wear are actually sun protective in themselves,
sweater,
except for a white T-shirt that's wet, which doesn't provide much SPF at all. So, you know, darker clothing, more tightly woven clothing itself is a good protector if someone doesn't want to invest in the more expensive clothing. And again, I know these are now being sold in sports stores and outdoor gear stores rather than just a more boutique market for some of the sun protective clothing. So the prices are coming down. So now I'll have you comment on the RIT, but we have not seen great consumer uptake for that product, which is supposed to add more of an ultraviolet protection factor to the clothing.
And what about, here's Lizette, Susan Sweater, says, what about vitamin D? Are we preventing absorption if we use sunscreen or cover our bodies when we're outdoors?
You know, interestingly, we were involved in a study that showed that the sun protective behaviors themselves, sun avoidance, wearing clothes, protective hats, eyewear, et cetera, is more likely to reduce vitamin D levels than sunscreen itself. And that may be because consumers aren't that good about putting on sunscreen and don't put on what they need. But there is clear evidence that aggressive sun protection behaviors can reduce vitamin D levels. That being said, the safest way then to achieve those vitamin D levels apart from diet is to increase and take vitamin supplements, which are very safe of the vitamin D3 level. These are well documented to safely increase one's vitamin D3 levels, which is the important vitamin that we're trying to get into the skin and for sun protective and other bone health purposes.
And Tina Clark, we talked to you a moment ago about sunscreen, the sun affecting people while they're driving. David asks, since glass blocks UVB, no one wears sunscreen in a car, but I don't think glass blocks UVA, so is driving or sitting near a window all the time adding significantly to risk? I think it is, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Yes.
End of that question, and we'll go to more of your questions by phone. Alan, hi, you're on.
Hi, this is Dr. Alan Algazi, University of California, San Francisco. I just wanted to point out that it's never too late to seek care for melanoma. We've been making incredible strides treating what used to be a lethal, a death sentence for all patients, which is metastatic melanoma. There are now new treatments to enhance the native immune response that can put patients into remissions that can last for years, particularly PD-1 antibodies and anti-CTLA-4 antibodies. So we have a lot of new treatment, and I would encourage people to seek them out if they find themselves with more advanced disease.
Well, as long as you're calling in here, Alan, I think it goes without saying, it's the earlier detection, the better chance of dealing and the better chance of surviving, yeah?
Well, that's absolutely true. So there's no substitute for early detection. And actually, getting back to the caller who had the concern about this being a white person's disease, no, there are certain kinds of melanoma that are equally common in people of color. Bob Marley died of an acromelanoma of his great toe, which he did not treat promptly, and it eventually metastasized, including to his brain. So there are certain kinds of melanoma that can be seen in minorities. And so if you see a dark lesion or something that's concerning, definitely seek immediate medical attention.
All right, and I thank you for that call. And let me go back for a moment to you, Susan Sweater. I've got a listener here named Bonnie who says, should I do anything special living at 5,000 feet?
That's a great point. And just to add to what Alan just said from UCSF, that from 1992 to 2008, we've seen actually the annual melanoma incidence in Hispanics increase by almost 20%. So we are seeing more melanomas, more other types of skin cancer in darker skin individuals, and so this should not be labeled as a disease of only fair skin individuals. Now, altitude itself, from the caller's question, does increase the amount of UVB that one is receiving. UVA is actually constant year-round and day-long, whereas UVB has varieties that we see in terms of or variations in altitude, seasonal daily variation as well as daily variation. So the UVB increases by about 4 to 10% per 1,000 feet of elevation, and so an individual would want to use a broad-spectrum sunscreen or a physical sunscreen, the titanium dioxide, zinc oxide forms that actually help to block that UVB. And UVB we're pretty good at blocking in the current sunscreens. Again, as Sonia mentioned, it's UVA that most of our U.S. sunscreens don't effectively achieve the filtration of.
And again, Susan Sweater is professor of dermatology at the Stanford University Medical Center and director of the Stanford Melanoma Program. And Jamie joins us from Oakland. Good morning.
Good morning. So I went to New Zealand this past winter for a month, and I am very pale-skinned. I've never had a tan in my life. And I found it really interesting that their cancer society actually makes their sunscreen. And so I purchased some when I was down there. And since I've been back, I've actually purchased some again online because I found that it was much better than what I've tried to use here in terms of the texture of it going on and what it contains. I just trust it more. And then another observation that was really interesting was it was part of their culture. Like, we went to a park and there would just be a big bottle of sunscreen for everybody to use for free. And it was just something that I wish that we would see more of here.
We can learn a lot from the Kiwis.
Yeah.
Thank you for educating on that, Jamie. I appreciate the call. You're reporting from New Zealand experience. Let me go to another caller. Josie, thanks for waiting. Join us. Hi.
Hey, thanks so much. My question is about the wait time suggested on sunscreen lotion. A lot of them suggest 15 to 20 minutes or so after application before you get into the sun. Is that just because you need that much time for it to be absorbed into the skin, or is there actually some sort of detrimental effect that going into the sun in that period will have on the efficacy of the sunscreen?
Yeah, Sonia Lunder, let's go to you again.
I don't know specifically the answer. I think that it is important to give the sunscreen time to soak into the skin and actually adhere to the skin before you're out in the sun. I think that, we all too often smear it right on and jump in the water immediately. And, you know, it's easy to imagine that that is just, not a practice that will allow it to stick to your skin and that it will all be in the swimming pool by the time you get out. I find that putting on sunscreen before we leave the house is the best way to really make sure that we have a wait time when I'm going out with my young children. And again, reapplying as frequently as every 2 hours, more often if you've been in the water, you're rubbing your body with a towel or you're sweating.
Sonia Lunder, another question from a listener named Sandra about sunscreens who asks, if sunscreens are so important, why are they so expensive, come in small amounts, and are so uncomfortable to wear, much less reapplying all day?
Well, I think that is the riddle. We find that a good sunscreen is one not only that has good sun protection, is free of ingredients of concern, but it's something that people will wear. And, you know, part of it, I think, is habit. We have been exploring partnership with sunscreen companies and also a company, Canfield, that makes UV photography. And this is a really powerful tool to have people see and visualize the skin damages that they have occurred that have occurred to them through a lifetime of sun exposure, but not yet visible to their skin. I think the problem is this lag time between the sun exposure you may get when you're a kid and you're outside all the time in your body. Your skin is not as developed and maybe doesn't have the same protective capacity. And the age of 65 when you may end up getting diagnosed with skin cancer of any form. And so we're trying to partner with sunscreen companies and also with this company, Canfield, that makes the UV photography machine to actually help people understand. Right now there's this mismatch. It feels inconvenient. It seems expensive to put on sunscreen. But decades down the line, if you're developing, you know, melanoma or pre-melanoma lesions, you would be quite worried and probably wish you could go back in time and take better care of your skin. The time to start is now, and we're trying to figure out tools to help people visualize and get a feeling for that, the risk that they face.
Now I'm going to go to more of your calls here. I'm just wondering, though, Tina Clark, you may not have the answer to this, but a Facebook listener named Ali, is this linked in any way higher rates of breast cancer in Marin County? Do we know anything? You're the epidemiologist. What do we know?
Yeah, so we have the highest rates of both breast cancer and melanoma in California in Marin County, and that goes back to, again, the rich white people and the very different demographic profile.
And my conspiracy.
Yes, your conspiracy. Yes. So we do see the patterns of cancer, you know, kind of go along with common risk factors. So different aspects of lifestyle related to greater levels of affluence, kind of the risk factors cluster together. We do see cancer rates move together for some of those things. So, yes, they are related.
And we'll go to another caller, and that's you, Eleanor. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi. My question is, so I'm a horseback rider, so we have to spend all day out in the sun. And my question is on the effectiveness of the shirts that they say specifically protect against things like UVA, UVB rays, and also whether you should still wear sunblock under those shirts on your arms and such.
Yeah, Susan's sweater.
You don't need to wear sunscreen underneath the sun protective clothing per se. So you want to protect your hands and your face. You've probably got a helmet on. And so the sun protective clothing does a very good job. And I think it becomes too sticky, and again, we want to increase consumer use, not try to have people deal with sunscreen and clothing on top of it. There are some very hopeful research avenues going on for sunscreens and things that we might be able to take systemically, fern leaf extracts. One of them is called polypodium. It's been studied now in people with a particular sensitivity to the sun, some carotenoids, other antioxidants, polyphenols, and a number of agents I'm hoping that can supplement what we're doing for sun protection to really enhance our practices.
And let me thank the caller. That was Eleanor, and this is Gary. Gary, join us.
Yes. Hi. I was aware of the fact that people get cancer more with their left arms and left faces, and that we talked about earlier in the show. And it occurred to me last night that maybe there's some sort of screen that you could put on the left part of your car. So I Googled it last night, and I think 3M has some sort of screen. So I wanted to know if what you think of such things, are they effective?
I'm Tina. Happy to address that.
Or, yeah, no, Tina Clark.
Or Susan, go ahead.
You know, there is the tinted glass is better than untinted glass. And so that kind of tinting in the driver's side where we do see more photoaging, non-melanoma skin cancers and melanoma, you know, it's true for the passenger side. For someone who's on the right side, that's also been shown. So tinted glass is better than untinted. Traditionally, some of those products have been expensive for consumers to use. Laminated glass is actually in the windshield, and it filters all of UVB and most UVA light. The problem is, though, laminated glass is not really in the overhead windows or on the side windows. So if you are a person who drives a lot, it may well be worth investing in the tinted glass, at least on the driver's side window.
Another question from a listener who says, I have three internationally adopted grandchildren, two from China, one from Guatemala. My daughter and son-in-law don't use sunscreen for the kids because the skin is medium brown, not black. They tan deeply. Should they be using sunscreen? Can we go to you on this, Dr. Sweater, again?
Yes, I would say absolutely. As I mentioned and had been alluded to by one of the callers, we are seeing increased skin cancer rates, both melanoma and non-melanoma types, across the board in all racial ethnic groups. It just happens, though, that when you look at cancer statistics, over 95% of melanoma tends to be in white populations. But that does not to say, you know, we're seeing about a 20% increase in melanoma in Hispanics over the last 15 to 20 years. And a lot of this we would attribute to increased sun exposure and no protection because people think they're safe. We also tend to see different types of melanoma in darker skin individuals, palms and soles, maybe less sun-related, but the sun-related melanomas are going up in dark skin individuals.
And here's, again, Susan Sweater, an email from a listener named Laura who says, I am one of your melanoma patients. That's Dr. Sweater's. Several years ago, you recommended Anthelios, am I pronouncing that right, by La Roche-Posay as the best sunscreen protection for skincare patients. Do you still recommend that, or has any new sunscreens been developed that you would recommend?
So this speaks to specific product recommendations, and what I'm actually going to recommend is one of the agents that the FDA is, we hope, going to approve within the next year. It's a broad-spectrum UV filter. The trade name of the filter is called Tinosorb, T-I-N-O-S-O-R-B. There are a couple of chemical names that go along with that, bisoprolol and bimotrizinol. And this really is the most effective and safest broad-spectrum sun filter that we have. It goes all the way through the ultraviolet A range. If you Google Tinosorb-containing sunscreens, you will, again, not be able to obtain these in the United States. But many of my patients who are very sun-aware, having had melanoma, or being at high risk for such, will obtain these from other countries. And I always tell patients if they're traveling to get sunscreen from developed countries because they are significantly better than ours. We have the worst sunscreen filters of any developed country in the U.S.
Now, so why is that? That's a mystery to me.
Well, I think Sonia touched on this wonderfully. Yeah.
It's FDA?
Yes, the time and extent application, TEA application, was supposedly going to allow the FDA to review sunscreen agents that have been used in other countries safely over a relatively quick period of time, only about 180 days, but now we're 8 years into these UV filters being reviewed in the United States, and there are about 6 to 8 that were awaiting approval. One of them is Tinosorb. There are other ones, triazines, octyltriazone, that are superior to anything we have on the market. And so I think we're a little bit behind. We're definitely behind, and hopefully the Sunscreen Innovation Act will move the FDA to make decisions on these agents.
Sonia Lunder, let me go to you because I'm looking at an email here from a listener named Kim who says, can we have some comments about the risks of sunscreen? Doesn't EWG publish a report saying the ingredients in most sunscreens are toxic? And also, isn't there concern that people suffer ill effects from blocking all sun exposure, including in particular vitamin D deficiency, as well as mental health effects in some people? I personally feel sun exposure has health benefits as well as risks.
Well, there's a lot wrapped up in that question. We are concerned about the lack of sun protection from many products on the U.S. market. We're concerned that the rules are too weak to allow poor quality products to be sold. One thing we haven't touched on yet is a concern we've raised about an ingredient that's a form of vitamin A that's put in about 25% of the sunscreens we see on the market, and that's called retinol palmitate. And actually, data by the U.S. government, FDA and National Toxicology Program has raised concerns that when it's put on sun-exposed skin, that it causes a damaging breakdown product and can increase the rate or the speed of skin tumors and skin lesions. And this isn't an animal study. They're currently doing more confirmatory tests of the effects of this form of vitamin A on sun-exposed skin. But to us, it seems like another sign that sunscreens are poorly regulated and that ingredients are being added that have little benefit and potential risk. And the FDA is not quickly responding to that kind of data and guiding the market. And the market isn't voluntarily shifting to avoid some concerning ingredients. There's this balance. We want products to be as good as they can be, and we want people to use them properly and employ those kind of more protective and lower cost and, safer alternatives like covering up their skin, wearing a hat, wearing glasses, wearing UV protective clothing, or just even regular clothing, as was pointed out. And we see this integrated message that's necessary. You know, melanoma rates are going up all over the globe. No one's exactly sure what we can do about it, but those few tools we have and the knowledge that we have about things that work, we need to be using as fully as possible.
I'm going to bring in another caller who's on point here. Kathy joining us from Fort Lauderdale. Good morning, Kathy.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
We're trying to make life safer for those who might be getting vulnerable to melanomas, so I'm feeling good about that. Go ahead. Sorry.
Right. Well, I was diagnosed maybe a year ago with a spot on my back that was melanoma. I'm from South Florida, and I've been worshiping the sun for 40 years of existence. And I've used minimal sun protection in the past, but now I'm trying to be diligent and show my family, my kids, how to protect themselves as well. But I'm concerned about the chemicals that I'm, ingesting through my skin on a daily basis all the time, and what long-term effects does that have? I mean, I realize there's cancer, but what comes from that?
I'd be happy to.
Yeah, Susan Sweater, go ahead.
Yeah, so I just want to comment also on the retinol palmitate. So the FDA is not questioning the safety of any ingredients in marketed sunscreens. And many of the safety concerns that have been raised are actually based on laboratory investigations and cell cultures, mouse rat models, and really don't have a real-life application in humans. In other words, these agents that have been looked at in the lab are being used in thousands or hundreds of times the concentrations they'd be used in humans. They're being ingested in the laboratory animals or injected. And, in fact, the skin is a terrific barrier. That's why most of the cosmetic claims that you'll see for something that's going to rejuvenate your skin, they don't work, because the skin really does prevent most ingredients from getting through it.
Your largest body organ.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But the retinol palmitate, has actually been soundly refuted by the FDA to cause any kind of cancer in terms of its use in sunscreens. And, in fact, it's a derivative of vitamin A. And we use vitamin A systemically in patients to prevent skin cancer. And so I think that, again, there are some concerns that get reported, but they're really not based on sound scientific data that have real-life applications in humans. I wouldn't hesitate to use the sunscreens on the market right now. The major issue we are seeing is photoallergic contact dermatitis from benzophenone, and that is the most common UVB filter in the U.S. So if you do have a reaction to the skin, or your skin turns red or itchy following sunscreen use, then we're going to recommend that most individuals switch over to the chemical-free sunscreens, which are the zinc oxide and micronized zinc oxide, though those sunscreens don't tend to block into the UVA range to the same degree as the chemical sunscreens. So it's a confusing issue, and there's a lot of, I believe, misinformation out there, and it's hard to sort through. Sprays are the most common vehicle now, being sold. Over 50% of all sunscreen products being sold are sprays, whether we like it or not. I share Sonia's concerns that these aren't necessarily going on in an even or thick application on the skin, and certainly the issues of aerosolization.
And let me thank Kathy for the call. It is a confusing issue, as you said, Dr. Sweater. I'm going to go to another email here from Sarah. And Tina Clark, let me get your response to this. She says, I grew up in Australia where sun protection is the norm, especially in schools. I was horrified to find my son's preschool here in California had no shade and most kids did not wear hats. The director was not responsive and seemed just not to get the concern, even after my very fair-skinned son was sunburned twice. What can parents do to promote sun-smart behavior in schools? Is there an advocacy group we can bring to our schools?
Absolutely. This is, again, just a part of a big cultural shift that we have around acknowledging the lifelong effects of excessive sun exposure. And the Australians are, as we've said, way ahead of the game, as are the New Zealanders, with the investing in the public health and research that it's going to take to get programs into schools and even into the preschools that will provide the, physical barriers like shades over the playgrounds and shady places for the kids to play, as well as the practices helping kids take the time to put sunscreen on before they go out to recess, helping understand what these barriers are to kids wearing longer sleeve and more sun protective clothing. Doing all of that work, we just see a pretty massive underinvestment in this area in the United States relative to other countries. So I absolutely share the emailer's concern that we are way behind the ball here in the United States relative to Australia and elsewhere.
Listener writes, this is Jane, this will serve perhaps as a caveat. She said, I attended a memorial service yesterday for a cousin who died from vaginal melanoma, the cure rate being less than 3%. Another very close friend died from melanoma of the eyelid, which has led to the enucleation of her eye and surround muscles so that she couldn't even have a prosthesis. Neither one of these people had ever had a skin melanoma, and in both cases, the melanoma has metastasized to other organs, including the brain. Here's a question about body hair. It's a tweet, and perhaps you can help us here, Susan Sweater. Steve wants to know, what role does body hair play in preventing skin cancers? Are hairier people less susceptible than those with less hair?
It's a very interesting point. I think the short answer is yes, because we see more skin cancers and melanomas on the scalp of men with thinning hair or bald scalp than we do in individuals with hair. And in fact, we are trying to educate scalp hairdressers to learn warning signs for melanoma and other skin cancers and to let patients know, because it's not a frequently examined site of the body. In point to your other message from the caller who had the two friends who passed away from non-skin melanoma, those are mucosal melanomas in the vaginal area, and then there is a separate type of melanoma called ocular melanoma. It can be more like a skin melanoma if it's on the eyelid, but it can actually be in the deeper layers of the eye and really generally not sun-related, although some eye melanomas are. Those are very different cancers. They're not, you know, they really do spread to different types of the body than we see with skin cancer, and they're very, very difficult to treat.
Well, we've come to the end of this hour, and it's been a lot of useful information, and I want to thank all the guests. Tina Clark, research scientist with the CPIC, the Cancer Prevention Institute of California, lead co-author on the recent report about melanoma incidence in Marin County. Susan Sweater, professor of dermatology at Stanford University Medical Center and director of the Stanford Melanoma Program there, and Sonia Lunder, senior analyst with the Environmental Working Group, which is a nonprofit public health and environmental research group that puts out a yearly report evaluating sunscreens. Another hour of the forum program up ahead, and we're going to talk about caretaking. It has become, well, more and more of an issue with more and more people as the baby boomers' parents get older and they age as well. So stay tuned for that. Let me thank all those behind the scenes here. This idea, by the way, didn't come from me. I just want that on the record for today's program. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Altman-Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.